The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to part three of our series on Lavina Lynn Johnson. So where we last left off, we were discussing sexual assault statistics in the military versus in civilian life and why the family was worried about Lavina overseas. So I'm again joined by Mel from Mask of Sanity podcast and my co-host from The Path Went Chilly, Dr. Ashley Wellman. Are you both ready to jump back in?
I'm ready, Jules.
I am ready.
So Lavina's father, Dr. Johnson, was obviously worried about the men who were on base and the way that they were going to treat his daughter, Lavina. He respected his daughter's opinion, but he told her if she wasn't going to take action, talk to somebody on base and get a battle buddy, then he was going to contact the senator and make sure she was assigned a battle buddy. But unfortunately, Dr. Johnson never got the chance.
On the day before Lavina was found deceased, she had gotten off work around 5 p.m. and then called her parents and chatted with them for a while about Christmas, their tradition, and made sure to let them know that she might be able to come home earlier than expected. So they were all really excited about that. According to her parents, she was full of life and just really excited at the prospect of being reunited with her family for their holiday festivities.
So later on that evening, Lavina hung out with a male soldier for a few hours. So the two of them talked in his room about their lives. He even encouraged his roommate to leave so that the two of them could be alone. But when the roommate came back, the two of them were just talking. Lavina wasn't going to stay there all night. She had plans for the morning and obviously curfew. She was going to be going for a run with some other soldiers when she woke up. So when she showed up in her friend, the male soldier's room to hang out, she was apparently wearing her running shoes, pants, and was geared up for her run at 8 a.m. the next morning, complete with a reflector belt. But it sounds a little bit strange, but with regards to what she was found wearing, it seems to line up with this. So I'm not sure if she planned to just sleep in the clothes, jump out of bed, and then go for a run, and then potentially just shower after. I know, obviously, like it sounded a little bit odd to me that, you know, she would be at night around midnight wearing this. You'd think she would sleep in her pajamas, but maybe Lavina just wasn't a morning person.
I don't know. For me, when I hear it, it's like, could she just have been planning to stay up all night at this guy's house? Like, I need a friend. I want to just stay up. Or, and then she just said, I'll just wear my clothes over.
I'm going to jump in here a little bit for the military aspect of it. It's not that uncommon if you're in a deployed location or a training location where you're like in a field to wear your PT gear or something like that as pajamas, just because like you're in a combat zone, something could happen in the middle of the night. You need some sort of like actual clothing on, uniform. I can remember in basic training, we slept in our PT uniforms. I mean, we had pajamas that were issued to us, but you never slept in them. So yeah, it sounds weird, but it's not as uncommon as you would think. So hopefully that clarifies that, makes it a little less wonky. But you're right, Ashley. Like she could have been maybe planning to stay up all night. Maybe she was planning to hang out with this guy or friends. We don't know. That's the scary thing. We really don't know. But it's not that weird that she would be in her running gear and sleep in it and just jump up and go, because they probably had to be up crazy early. So
they had curfew at midnight, apparently. So how easy was it for them to skip curfew? Say like she was going to do what Ashley said, stay up all night, maybe hang out with this guy. Would it be easy to get away with something like that?
I wouldn't think so. There's usually, and granted, I've never been deployed, so I'm just basing this on what like we had to do at the academy. There were Air Force officers assigned daily to basically patrol the grounds. And after curfew, after TAPS, like you had to be in your dorm room, you had to be asleep, or like, you know, people were studying or whatever, but any kind of socialization should have stopped at curfew. It doesn't mean that people didn't sneak out or do things like that. It definitely happened. I may have broken that rule once or twice. It happened. Like you're just a young kid, late teens, early 20s, like you're going to push the boundaries a little bit, but there probably was at least one person, possibly more, assigned to kind of do that patrol and make sure that everybody was where they were supposed to be. Because it goes back to the whole accountability thing and like making sure that people are where they're supposed to be at a certain time. So it probably wouldn't be easy to get away with, but it's definitely possible.
Wouldn't it also matter like how far away this guy's room was? Because like basically if my curfew is I would check in with my commanding officer or whatever, and then I'm in my dorm-ish area. So maybe he's three halls over, or maybe he's within the same little building.
Been super close.
Yeah. And so then it's like, I don't really care what you guys are doing. We're deployed in Iraq, but you better be in this building so I know where your butt is, like where I know your body's in this building somewhere.
Right.
And then I'm okay with it. Like I could see it being a little bit more lax in that way if he was close. Now, she's going a long distance from her room.
Right. Yeah. She's like going to the other side of the base. Hard to say. Like, I don't know how the tents were set up or whatever they were sleeping in.
They were in buildings. They were in buildings, and he was in a different building.
Were they all like centralized in the same part of the base? I don't know. Were they kind of spread out? Did they keep males and females separate, like spread out, not just in separate buildings, but physically distanced too? I don't know. But I mean, it's possible, unless we had a schematic of the layout of the base.
This will come up later, but there is, I think, some distance between the two buildings because there's differing accounts between the roommate who spoke about like what his friend had told him with regards to how far he walked Lavina. He said that he walked Lavina to her building, and then the roommate said he walked her halfway back. If the buildings were right beside each other, he'd just walk her right up to the building. You'd think you wouldn't just like, you'd be like, oh, I can see her. She's within sight. So I basically walked her to the building. If you're only walking someone halfway back, you can't really see the building. Otherwise, I think you'd say, I can see the building. I walked her there.
Right.
What about sex on base? Are there any rules with regards to that?
I'm sure there are. I don't know.
Rules
are
made to be broken, baby.
Right.
Rules are made to be broken.
I mean, we had rules at the academy. I mean, if a male and a female were not allowed to be in a dorm room with the door closed.
So I think Margo told me that
the door had to be open.
I think Margo told me that sex was prohibited when you're deployed.
It probably was. I mean, you're there to focus on the mission and not extracurricular activities. So yeah, that's not the mission that they're sent there for.
Yes.
Still happens. That's the thing.
You've got a bunch of young kids, right? That they've all got their hormones raging.
Even not so young people. Like it happens. So
of course. It's a stressful situation. People are going to look for a stress release wherever they can.
Right.
They're not drinking and doing drugs for the most part. So what are people going to look to do? They're going to seek comfort in other people.
Yeah, exactly. Lavina and her male friend visited the post exchange and they bought several items. Lavina bought chapstick, soda, and some M&Ms. At this point, her parents must have been able to get a hold of her PIN number for the bank card because she was able to purchase these items with no problem. Then they went to a fast food restaurant where her male friend got some items to go. And after they left the PX, this is what you were saying, Jules. He said he walked her back to the building and watched her go inside. But his roommate said in his interview that this soldier had walked her only halfway home. So there's a difference in versions there, but in any event, this male friend arrived back to their room around 11:30 p.m. midnight and woke up his roommate. They shared a chicken sandwich and said that he and Lavina had only kissed, which he was surprised that it was only that, but he wasn't disappointed according to what the roommate said.
So the question is, did Lavina go back to her room that night? There seems to be some items missing from Lavina's room, such as her CD case that another soldier claimed Lavina had left for him. This was possibly the same individual that said she'd left a bag of chapstick. So this is what the Army uses to support Lavina giving items away, which can be indicative of someone's desire to potentially complete suicide. The report is heavily, heavily redacted. And like I've said earlier on, there's no numbers or letters used to label individuals. Sometimes there are clearly multiple interviews with the same person. So I really apologize if that's unclear because I had to read over and over and over again. And sometimes I was able to figure out, hey, this is the same person. This is the same story. But other times it was difficult. But one thing that was missing was the first one-third of the pages from Lavina's diary, which she reportedly was always writing in. They were torn out and never recovered. And let me be clear about one thing. There are quite a few statements, but the interviews are basic and they don't seem to dig very deep. So when one reads them, they'd easily get a sense of incompleteness, a report that really only scratches the surface. And I'm not saying that it's inaccurate, as the statements, like I said earlier, they do sound credible, but it feels like there's so much missing that it's hard to pull it all into context and not feel like there's something else going on here.
My concern is that if you wrote in a journal, why in the world would you tear one third of your pages out? Because that's your storytelling of your life, right? And whether I've changed and maybe I don't feel that way anymore, most of the time, if you're a journaler, those are like, you know, the blog of your life to yourself. And it's kind of important to see, even when things have changed or even when you don't feel the same, it's important to see that evolution of self. Like, that's why people journal. So I don't think she would be the one to tear those one third of the pages out of her journal. And when you said that she left a bag of chapstick, my thought was she had just been at the commissary and or exchange and had bought chapstick. So it's very possible it was still in a little shopping bag from the exchange. And then they're like, oh, she had packaged it up and ready to give it away, right? Clear sign of suicide attempt or something like that. So that to me doesn't have a whole lot of credibility. And then if you were going to complete suicide and I got your bag of chapstick, like, that's what you're giving me? Come on, man. Like, no, you don't share used chapstick with people. So I'm literally thinking that this is a bag that she had just bought chapstick and somehow they found that and they're saying she had packaged it for somebody. So that's, I don't know, to me, that struck me as very odd.
Yeah, it's really unclear what they were talking about here. If this is indeed the same bag of chapstick that she got at the PX, or if this was slightly earlier. But I also find the first one third of her pages being missing interesting, because what would have been happening right now, and like as of late on base, she'd only been there for a few months, would have been in the last pages of her journal, not the first third. So what I was wondering is if these first third maybe detailed that relationship with that guy that sounded like he was a bit of a manipulative guy and maybe was telling her some mistruths and trying to get what he wanted out of the situation and not acting with integrity. And if maybe that was contained in the first third of the pages, I don't know how that would relate to her death, but it just seems like if the first or if the last third was missing, it might tie it to an individual or certain things that may have happened to her in Iraq. But the first third, it just seems strange to me. What are your thoughts on that, both of you?
Well, my thought would be like, did she write in the second and third third of the journal, or were those empty pages? Do you know what I mean? So it's possible that she had started a new journal in Iraq. So those
maybe
first
that's all that was written on that first mm-hmm. third. So whoever did it was just going to take all of it.
Because Jules, your thought, your thought is that, and I agree with you. If this was like a completed journal, that first third would have been, a year ago or something. But I'm thinking I'd start like a new, like, okay, Iraq, grab a new journal, take it over there and start logging everything. And then depending on how long she was there, perhaps that one third, maybe there's only five pages after that, you know, that are written on or something to that extent.
But would you count pages that aren't written? Like if you're looking at somebody's journal and you see pages ripped out, I would only count pages that are written on as like the amount, rather than if there's blank pages, I would say all of the pages are taken out of her journal. Not just one third, all of the written pages are taken out, not just one third, because then that indicates that there's two thirds left, which in my personal opinion, it sort of looks like two thirds that are written on. And maybe it's a full journal. I mean, I don't know how they interpreted this. It's really tough to tell.
But there could be 10 pages or there could be 30 pages or there could be 500 pages. So it's like, maybe there is, like you said, maybe there's two thirds writing left, but that could account for eight pages of a journal, you know, like, they haven't really given us much detail. They didn't, again, like you said, it's incomplete.
And unless it's a full journal, how would they actually know how much was written on there before, right? It would need to be almost a completed journal. And we're probably putting so much thought into this. We don't even know how they approached this. Did they just go literally, is it one third of the pages and there's only empty pages remain? Or there's a full journal and two thirds of written pages remain? I guess it would be so significant if it was all written pages.
But I mean, that's literally all they have to go on in terms of trying to justify her giving things away or getting rid of stuff to justify it as a suicide. Because all they have are some missing CDs, a bag of chapstick, and pages out of a journal missing.
There's a knife as
That's not a lot.
And there's a knife. There's a knife as well. One that they, I can't remember what they call it, but it's one that they, it's, you have to have it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like something that is, I don't know what you,
but it's like issued to you.
Issued to you.
That personally belonged to her. So
yes.
That if it wasn't personally hers, again, like that really shouldn't count either. Cause why would you care what happens to an issued knife if you're contemplating suicide? Like in my mind, when somebody starts giving things away because they're leading up to that, they're giving away things that mean something to them mm-hmm. that they want someone else to have as a way to remember them. There's like, mm-hmm. she's not going to care about a knife if it
means chapstick
to her. Right. Or chapstick, really. Right. And CDs go missing left and right. I lose them all the time. So I really think they're pulling at straws here with trying.
And with the journal pages, it could have been too, like, I mean, you can tell, like, you know, when someone rips a page out, you can tell how many have almost mm-hmm. been torn out. Cause it's not usually a clean tear. So it's possible, let's say she literally wrote 12 pages in her journal. It's possible they looked at this, you know, at the torn out things. They went, well, 1, 2, 3, 4 tabs are here. Okay. Mm-hmm. So 4 pages were ripped out and then 8 pages are left. There's a third of it missing. So I think you could, I mean, I think it was actually important. I know we're nitpicking, but I think it was important to know that detail. And like you said, all they gave us was the proportion. So we have no idea what that was looking like.
Yeah, it just seems like, wouldn't they say all the written pages are taken out of her journal, not just 1/3? Because why do those 2/3 matter if there's no writing on them? That's what I'm like hung up on, right? If why would you say 1/3? It would almost indicate.
Well, there could have been more written pages, but like there could have been 800 written pages or there could have been 8 written pages, you know? So it's like they didn't, it's important to know the magnitude of the
complete lack of detail for a military investigation. Is astonishing in this case because mm-hmm. they thrive on detail. Everything it's paying attention almost to a OCD kind of level. Like mm-hmm. you have to know the ins and outs of everything. So the fact that there was so little detail, which is why we're speculating the way we are, really says a lot because you don't just kind of write something down. At least I can remember if you had to send a report or something and someone else higher up looked at it and they're like, you should probably have this in there too. They would send it back and you would correct it and then send it through again for approval. Like you don't just half-ass stuff. And it really feels like this entire investigation was because there's something sketchy going on here.
It's just one detail, but it matters, right? Like was there any of Lavina's personal private thoughts remaining on the pages of that journal? And that's just one of those things we don't know. And when you read this report, it is so entirely incomplete. And like you said, Mel, like this is an organization that thrives on detail. And even in there's interviews and statements given, there's no probative questions. There's no digging to find any more answers. It's like, they're just taking everything at face value. And that's what it feels like. And they're just literally scratching the surface. And I don't know if there is or there isn't stuff missing, but that's the way that it feels like to me when I look at it, because it feels like this is just like, okay, this is enough. We're going to put this out here, close this case. And, mm-hmm. you know, anything that goes against this narrative, maybe we won't include. And I'm not saying they did or they didn't do that, but that's the way that it appears to me.
So between 1:20 a.m. and 1:30 a.m., a sound would be heard that ear witnesses described as a car backfiring or someone shooting into a barrel. Witnesses quickly go to investigate and see what was described as 2 fires burning, gray smoke, a body under a bench with an M16 cradled over her left shoulder and debris around her, as well as an aerosol can. Those who came upon the body saw a dark pool of blood and said it wasn't moving and then saw the trauma to her head. The 2 fires burning were a problem. So one of the individuals thought quickly and looked outside, found a garbage can and proceeded to fill it with dirt in order to put out the fire. Multiple people say the bench over Lavina began to burn again. So they drug the bench outside of the tent. And also, most report the gun as being on her left side, but there was one individual that says it was underneath of Lavina. Yet the rough crime scene sketch depicts the gun a great distance from the body. I don't know why there's such a discrepancy here. Again, attention to detail, folks. Like, you have to get this right. Not necessarily for the witnesses, because I can't imagine the shock of walking in on a body and a fire and that kind of chaos, but to whoever did the crime scene sketch, it's your job to be as accurate as possible. There's also a footprint on the rough crime scene sketch, and Dr. Johnson alleges it was smeared in blood, but I could find nothing to corroborate that. He also alleges that there were drops of blood outside the tent, and again, no source to corroborate that. That isn't to say he's incorrect, just that he might have an inside source who's relaying this information, and that source just hasn't gone on the record yet. So we will say this again and again throughout our discussion. We absolutely believe that when Dr. Johnson says something, there is validity to his statements.
I could easily see somebody contacting Dr. Johnson and being a source from the inside and saying, like, they're not telling you the truth. I cannot be exposed. Like, look what they did to her. I'm terrified. But if you want to, absolutely a whistleblower. But if you want information, I'll share it with you. So a couple of questions, like, do we know if she was left-handed?
Ooh, good question.
Ooh, I don't think so, but I can't say. I feel like it would have come up at some point. I mean, right, I don't know how a gun would fall, but there's only like 10% of the population is left-handed. I feel like it might have been drawn attention to, but I can't say with any high degree of certainty she's right-handed. I'm just kind of speculating.
Well, that definitely piqued my interest when they said, okay, the gun was on the left side of her body, because if you're completing suicide with a gun, right, you would think that whichever hand yours, your dominant hand is going to be the hand you're using to guide this process. But also, an M16 is a huge military rifle. And so she would have been issued a handgun as well, or at least have had access to a handgun on a military base. So if she really was set on planning out a suicide, to me, you would go get a handgun to do this, because there's a closeness and a more confidence that you're going to be successful in your attempt. Statistically, it used to be that women were way less likely to use a gun in a suicide. That number's actually almost become equal with men because of desperation, right? And wanting to complete the act. But we do know that when you look at even suicide by guns, you know that handguns are used far more than any other type of weapon are going to be used. In fact, I think it's like 4 times more likely that someone's using a handgun versus a shotgun, a rifle, something like that. So when you combine this gun and the discrepancies, you have this bench over her and then the two fires. What are you going to set a fire to yourself and then shoot yourself with a long rifle when you're 5'1"? This very much led me to think this would be a homicide. And the last thing before my rant's over, do we know what that aerosol can could have been?
It was something like hairspray or something like that.
I assumed it would have been like something to help start the fire.
That's what I thought.
Like an accelerant. Yeah. Spray it on her, light it. And
it was in the file and it was some type of accelerant that they assumed was used during the fire. And it was something like hairspray, if I remember correctly, but it might be something different. But either way, they speculated it was used to kind of as an incendiary kind of device or whatever. But like, why is she under the bench to begin with?
What?
And who knows where the gun is going to land with kickback if you're shoved under a bench?
M16 has quite a kickback. It's like, to go back to your point, Ashley, versus a rifle versus a handgun when going through with suicide, she's tiny. An M16 has quite a kick. And it would just make more sense to go with a handgun because you would be able to control it more.
Yes.
But Dr. Johnson said she wouldn't have access to a handgun. He said that would be something only her superiors would have access to. He believed it was closer to a 9mm wound that Lavina would sustain. And we'll get more into that later. But he thought that pointed towards somebody from the outside murdering her and not Lavina doing it. But he said it would be hard to get her hands on a 9mm. I don't know how difficult or easy that would be, but he seemed to think that it wasn't possible.
Interesting. My friends who were deployed overseas said we had access to both, but it could be which branch and it could be, I guess, what position you are too. Yeah.
So as we mentioned earlier, Lavina would be found in one of the contractor tents. So it was a place where soldiers were prohibited from going. And in the report, it was basically going to be used for those who were doing construction on like one of the parts of the base, but it had been in disuse for about a month. I'm not familiar with the rules on contractor tents, but I did see the photos of this specific tent and it was beyond basic. It was teeny tiny. There was a dirt floor. There appeared to be one window. There was a desk and a bench in the tent. And Dr. Johnson says that the individuals in the army were referring to this as Lavina's tent, which is so weird. But again, in the documents, there's no mention of that. This is important because it seemed to be communicated to the Johnsons that this was potentially her barracks. So one could then see why they were upset when they found out that it wasn't Lavina's room. They wondered why she was there in the first place.
To me, and this goes beyond this case, right? This is why it's so important to accurately inform and use correct words, language, facts when you're talking to a family. Because when facts start to change or they start to crystallize into new realities, immediately the family takes that as a sign of distrust and like that you're lying to us now, that you're covering something up, and it causes a lot of unrest. So it causes additional emotional distress on the family. So I don't know that this was purposeful, but it could have more been the result of kind of chaos going on, right? Where people are just kind of scrambling. We've just had a murder on base. I don't know what's happening. And they're just telling the family information to keep them informed. But it's critical, the word choice, the information you pass along, when it's not right, it highly complicates the grief process following that.
The investigative file into Lavina's death seems lackluster at best, and a time of death was not specifically established. Her death was ultimately ruled a suicide, with Dr. Johnson claiming the army pathologist wouldn't call it a suicide based on the autopsy alone and needed to actually refer to the investigation. We were unable to find the autopsy report, so when referencing it throughout, we are going on information that Dr. Johnson is relaying regarding the state of Lavina's body. It was left out of the military's report that was shared by Margot from Military Murders, and it's not easy to find. So if we can't find a link to post it in the show notes, Jules is going to share her Google Drive link to the file so you can read what we do have available for yourselves.
So the pathologist stated that they couldn't conclude this certain cause of death without further information. But was that information coming it feels like that information was coming from like this complicated investigation, a haphazard, problematic investigation. So if he couldn't make that ruling, and then he's depending on the information that's found in this investigative report, right there, we have a major issue.
This is actually common with pathologists, though. Like, I actually talked to about another case. I was talking to a pathologist, Dr. Joe DeFlu. He's from Australia, and it was a completely unrelated case. And when I showed him the photos, he's like, okay, well, I need these variables, which are variables that only investigators can provide. So I think that that's pretty typical when it's if you're relying completely on that. But if you need this to go, okay, well, I need to know all of these different factors to plug this into my analysis in order to have a holistic view of what happened here.
What I'm saying, though, is that if the investigation was flawed or problematic, and that's what you're relying on, like, oh, crap, because then your cause of death is going to get complicated or wrong. And in this case, it seems like they got it wrong, but they're relying on this, quote, truth that's in this investigative report. And if it's done without the proper information or they're doing a cover up, then they're never going to get the ultimate answer because they're relying on faulty documents. That's my problem with it. That's why when you mess an investigation up, we have big issues.
Yeah, I've got some issues with if we rely on what Dr. Johnson has said, and we'll touch on this in greater detail as we move through the story. But some of these things that happened at the original autopsy, which were things like removal of, you know, there's a chunk of Lavina's tongue missing, there's a part of her vagina missing, part of her anus missing. These things aren't accounted for. There isn't a rape kit done. There's so many things where it's like, well, why did you do this? Like, I don't understand. There's just seems to be absolutely no reason. So it seems like we're not getting the full truth as to what was investigated, what was done, what was communicated to the pathologist. I can't say what's going on, but all I know is we don't know everything. We don't have all the facts here.
Those who found her must have thought the scene was strange right off the bat. Some sources say at some point a contractor heard what he believed to be a gunshot. When this person went to investigate, he found a small fire close to the body of a young woman who appeared to be injured or deceased. And upon closer inspection, he sees the woman lying on her back with her right arm draped over her eyes, almost as if she's shielding herself from something, like it's a defensive position.
So as we mentioned earlier, if Lavina was going to complete suicide, how and why would she lay underneath of a wooden bench? Dr. Johnson says not only is it physically impossible given the length of the barrel of the M16 and Lavina's short stature, but he also claims there are other visible injuries on his daughter, such as bruises and abrasions that cannot be explained away, with Lavina turning the gun on herself. He also says that her genitals had been burned with what appears to be lye. There, like I said, there was a section missing and her hands were burned. Injuries on her hands were later covered up with gloves that were then glued to her hands by obviously someone in the military. I don't know if it was the pathologist or somebody else. It's unclear how and why this happened. There are also questions surrounding the state of Lavina's teeth, with many, including Dr. Johnson, believing her teeth wouldn't have been so damaged from an intraoral gunshot wound. Like, she was missing a couple teeth and there were some loose. So if the barrel had basically passed her teeth and gone into her mouth, he doesn't believe there would be so much damage. And he's seen quite a few of these injuries personally. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
My first thought is, what in the world? What in the world? When you said the word lie, that lie was used on her body, that's something that is famously or infamously used by the Mexican cartel to like melt down bodies that they kill. So when you talk about the fact that once lye gets heated, right, and here we have a fire, it can literally disintegrate a body. So to me, the location of the lye, her genitals, like having damage done to, you know, those parts of her bodies, that really alludes to this anger or hate of her sexually, either because of something like a previous assault or sexual experience, or maybe the denial of sex. So there's something very personal to me about all of that. Maybe the gloves potentially were trying to be used to gather, I don't know, residue from her hands or something like that. But to hear that they were glued to her hands and then left that way doesn't make any sense. The bench doesn't make any sense. So my thoughts, what in the heck? What is going on here?
So we don't know for sure that lye was used. He was saying something like lye. It appears like she was burned with something like lye. So we don't know for a fact, but that was sort of, I think, his analysis based on what he'd seen. There was what appeared to be very clear burning, or I guess, or like the flesh almost like it had been melted. So yeah, why would that be done? And one thing that did cross my mind
is that this could have been contracted from some consensual relationship on base. It could have been from a sexual assault, or it could have been from her boyfriend from basic training. When Lovina spoke about how she hates how men cheat, she could have been alluding to that. I mean, it's impossible to know, and I'm only speculating. And perhaps, I'm not saying that this happened, I'm just spitballing here, but perhaps Lavina had a sexual encounter with somebody on base, and that person, as a consequence, contracted the STD that we know Lavina was being treated for, and there was a lot of anger surrounding that, and they then acted out, or chose to act out, for what they perceived to be a slight against them. And I think I just want to make clear that this is in no way meant to victim shame or blame Lavina. It's only meant to speak to a potential motive of a potential perpetrator trying to understand all of this hate that is directed towards her. I just wanted to make sure that that was very, very clear and that no blame is on Lavina whatsoever.
What's so scary to me is the rage that is behind what was done to her body. Burning her genitals. Think like that's not just something that happens when, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you find yourself in the heat of the moment and you kill someone. Like, this was thought out, it seems like, or at least attempted to be thought out. It was very sloppy, whatever they were trying to do to initiate a cover up or distract them into thinking that it was suicide and not murder. It's very sloppy murder. Mm-hmm. But just that rage. I don't know what other word to use to describe it. That anger at her that this person felt to do that kind of damage to her body wasn't enough to just shoot her. Or if there was strangulation or anything like that, even though it doesn't really seem like there's any evidence of that. This goes beyond just, in my mind, the heat of the moment. I almost feel like the attack on her was planned. In a way,
you don't always see evidence of like asphyxiation, though. If somebody puts a hand over the mouth or something like that, there's ways you can asphyxiate without leaving a mark. And so who knows, a gun could have just been used after the fact. Like, we'll talk about this more later, but there's so many different scenarios that could have played out. Yeah. And I don't know. I keep thinking like what you're saying, what you said, Ash, like maybe it was the denial of sex, because from what everybody said, like Lavina was really religious. I don't think that she was somebody who, from what I understand from all of the statements that I read, I don't believe since she was on that base that she was sexually active with anybody. That's my understanding. I can't say with any high degree of certainty what was her experience, but it did seem like she had this potentially blossoming relationship with this other soldier. But by his accounts, they weren't sleeping together. They'd only kissed. So I do think that there's less of a chance that it has to do with her potentially passing along an STD to somebody else, because I really don't believe that she was sexually active based on what everybody else has said. And everybody did speak very respectfully of her. And I know that can happen when, you know, somebody is deceased. I did get kind of the view that everybody who'd spoken about her had respect for her and the way that she conducted herself, and that she had a lot of integrity. And that's not to say that if somebody chooses to have multiple partners, they don't have integrity. But we're also talking about the way a lot of males felt towards her. And we know the way that males can interpret women when they choose to have multiple partners. So that leads me to believe that it may have been more in line with somebody wanted sex and they weren't getting that. And then that's why they chose to act out. It was a sexual assault. They maybe raped her and then chose to mutilate her essentially after the fact.
We mentioned earlier that there was 1/3 of Lavina's diary that was missing. There was what appeared to be burnt pages from Lavina's diary, or a burnt Bible, as both have been suggested. And on a side note, a couple of the soldiers, like you said, Jules, said that Lavina was very religious. And looking at the black and white photos of this debris, it is basically impossible to say what was written on those pages and if her diary entries were amongst the burnt paper. One does have to wonder, what did those entries in her diary say? There is speculation that maybe she did write something in there incriminating someone of sexual harassment or sexual assault. One of her fellow soldiers said that in the past, there's no real timeline given or context, but that one of Lavina's former boyfriends forced her to have sex without her consent. Some sources seem to point to this as being a recent sexual assault, but it only comes up once in the report and doesn't seem to necessarily be from Lavina's time in the military, though that isn't to say that that's not what happened.
There's a lot to unpack there. It's interesting when you look at the fact that we can't tell were these journal pages or were these Bible pages, because those are very different pages. Someone's handwriting on lined paper or plain paper versus typeset thin Bible pages, it seems like you would be able to distinctively tell this is writing paper or these are book pages. And Bible pages, every Bible has those, like, it's a different kind of like paper. You know, it's softer, it's lighter, it's got like a holy feel to it. And then you have journal pages that are very different. So it's odd that we don't know, one, what the pages around her were, or was it just maybe paper to start the fire or, like, you know, crumble stuff up? And they're just assuming, oh, this could be the missing pages of her journal. But the fact that none of the words are showing is weird, because even if the fire was burning, something wouldn't be completely burned. You know, it's not like this was a 4-alarm fire that's been burning for 8 hours. So I don't know. That's odd to me. And in the sexual assault, like we talked about last episode with the sexual assault statistics in the military, it's not impossible that she had been assaulted. But I also don't necessarily want to force that into the narrative, because we don't know. And only one report is saying that. It's possible someone's made a speculation knowing what happened to her body and they just made an offhand comment, and that's somehow in the report. But
sources are saying that, but they're going basically on nothing. And I think they're basically going on the report without actually having read the report. But having read the report, I'm inclined to believe she wasn't sexually assaulted on base, because she literally told nobody. This was just an abstract thing that it was an ex-boyfriend who had forced her to have sex. She said nothing about an ex-boyfriend while she was training. It could have been back quite a distance. That was the way the story was told. So I'm not saying that she couldn't have been sexually assaulted. Of course, that's possible. But I'm less inclined to believe that is indeed what happened prior to her death. I definitely believe there was some kind of sexual assault, you know, involved in her death, and that it was a sexually motivated offense. But I don't think necessarily that it happened to her prior, because I feel like we're making too much of a jump. And like you said, Ash, we're forcing it kind of into the narrative if we say that that did happen based on basically nothing. So I personally question if someone killed Lavina in the evening and then staged the scene with a gunshot and the small fire in the early morning hours around 1:20 a.m. to 1:30 a.m. So there's basically 1.5 to 2 hours since the soldier said that he walked Lavina back to her building. What was she doing during this time? Who was she with? So there was a curfew at midnight, to my understanding, since I had difficulty finding anything to do with body temperature, time of death, rigor mortis. This is impossible to discern. Like we said, we don't have access to the autopsy report. But curiously, Lavina was found on her back, but lividity or pooling of the blood was apparently found on her left side, which would indicate that the body was lying on its side for hours after Lavina's death and was later potentially moved in an attempt to stage the scene. Since after she was found, she wasn't rolled onto her left side. So if anything, she would have been put on her back. So it's weird we don't see lividity there. But again, even if she's found, it was basically a couple hours after she'd last been seen. Lividity takes hours to show up. So I'm still a little confused by this.
I'm very confused by that. Again, what are the reports saying here? It doesn't line up with, like you said, the way her body was actually found, which could indicate her body was moved to this location because whoever moved it thought that they could stage a suicide here. And maybe that's when the planning happened, Mal, right? Like it was a heat of the moment kind of thing. Again, maybe a denial of sex or something like that.
Sure.
And then you see, okay, crap. Now I have a body on my hands and let me get it to this tiny tent that no one's supposed to be in. I can make a plan. I can go figure out what I'm going to do. And then I can take care of the body. And like we said, who knows if there really was lye or these kinds of things used, but for sure a fire was set. And so there was an attempt to cover something. And so, Jules, I mean, maybe that's what's happening with the lividity. But like you said, it takes a while to see that arise, especially in like a significant, you know, you'll see little splotches, but if it's significant, then it would take a while. And we don't seem to have that in our time frame.
So then we question, like, was the body found exactly how they're saying it was found? Is there some kind of discrepancy? Like, when you read through the reports and the eyewitness statements, mostly across the board, they're the same. There's some strange things said, like, over the reports of a body being found face down. But no eyewitnesses are saying that. Ear witnesses are saying, like, people are saying there's a body found face down. So there is some differences here. And there's that one person who says that her body is found on her left side. So you're not getting the same answer across the board. And we know eyewitness testimony is problematic. But one thing I keep going back to, and I know this eyewitness or his roommate has corroborated his story, that he was back in the room and that they ate this chicken sandwich. But we know that this is like the last individual that's basically seen with Lavina, spending time with Lavina. We know he's got romantic feelings for Lavina because he's talking about kissing her and whatnot. So is somebody covering for him? Or is there just some random other guy that in this very short space of time just jumps in there, commits a sexual assault and a brutal murder?
Or could it have been somebody who saw her getting walked home by this other man and got really upset as well? Because I wouldn't say it's definitely the other guy. Now he did not get further with her, which he said he was kind of surprised, but not upset about. So that kind of sets off a little bit of a alarm bell. But it could have been somebody else who had deep feelings or even obsessed with her, right? And had felt something that maybe she didn't feel in return. And as she sees this man walking her back, there could be a rage that came over him too. So, I mean, a lot of potentials going on in this scenario.
It depends if he indeed did walk her back to her building or not too, right? Like if he walked her halfway back, then she's vulnerable to other people who may be, you know, hanging out in the shadows around 11:30, 11:45 at night. And they might see this opportunity to then assault Lavina. She could just be, you know, a sitting duck. But if he walked her right up to her dorm room door, like he said that he did, it's going to be a lot harder for somebody to victimize her because then they're then going to have to drag her out of this dorm room and pull her there. So I think all these variables are so, it really depends how opportunistic a crime this could be. Depends upon how alone Lavina was on this dark night. And did he indeed walk her to that door?
I could also see him as a friend, like the first time he's being questioned or when he tells, like, he'd be like, I walked her back. Like I walked her back to her dorm room. Like, cause the guilt and the shame of like, oh, shoot, you know, like, I should have been there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I could see that being the first thing that came out of his mouth. And then if that's not actually 1,000% accurate, I can't then take that back. Because if I take that back, now I'm lying in a murder investigation. So it's like, yeah, I'm going to stick to that story. So I could also see it being a half truth where it almost came out wrong and he's stuck in that story. You know what I mean?
That was my thought, Ashley. Because I mean, if you've never been questioned and someone that you liked and spent time with was found dead and you're being questioned about it, I mean, I would be freaking out a little bit and probably the wrong thing would pop out of my mouth too, or maybe something not completely true. So I think that's a possibility.
I think it's that was my initial thought when I read it. Either he's trying to cover his butt and look like a gentleman, because it's a little bit embarrassing when you're like, yeah, I just let her walk back halfway in the dark back to her place. I think a lot of people in that situation, they're going to panic. They know that she's mm-hmm. wound up dead. They're going to initially say that. But I think it's either that or he's not telling the truth for another reason. But I really don't know. There's just so little that we know about this investigation. We're left to really speculate about these people. We don't even know their names. We don't know the true nature of their relationships to Lavina. We're only going off of what they're saying and what's in this report. So we're really left with very little to parse through and then to kind of deduce this is a person that is, could be or couldn't be responsible. We really just don't know. We know there's a very small window of time. And coming back to the Bible or the diary pages, from the report, it seemed to be that they thought it was, like I'd heard in sources that it could have been her diary, but it seemed in the report, they more likely believed it was a Bible because they kept asking people if she carried around a Bible with her or if she was always reading a Bible. And then they said it was like possibly a Bible. But I don't know if those journal pages were missing and they were maybe burned first. And so there was no debris left. And maybe the Bible pages were burned second. It's all just so strange. And like, I keep coming back to what you said, Mel, this is an institution that thrives on detail and we have no detail here.
Detail and being honorable and integrity and telling the truth. So the fact that none of that seems to be happening on any level, no wonder we're speculating as much as we are, because we have nothing to go on that we know for sure is 100% true other than the fact that Lavina is dead. That's all we really know for sure.
So back to the small fires. So what was the purpose of burning these paper items? This seems rather elaborate if it was indeed a suicide. I suppose one could say that potentially someone went out of their way to read the diary and find any incriminating evidence and just get rid of it. But this makes me question if Lavina actually died from the gunshot wound or if she was killed by another means. Like I said earlier, perhaps she was smothered and then it just left no visible marks, and the gunshot with potentially a 9mm. We don't know if it was a 9mm or an M16 because they, you know, never got the shell casing, was used later to cover up the murder and point towards suicide. Total 100% speculation. But these questions are worth asking, as Dr. Johnson said that his daughter was covered with bruises and abrasions, which if this was a suicide, how and why would she be covered in bruises and abrasions? And this is like only an hour and a half after she was last seen. This is impossible to prove given what information we have to work with, but it is possible. But on a side note, the military issues 4 magazines for an M16, and Lavina had 3 and then 1 in her gun, so all 4 were accounted for. And I'm unsure if one bullet was used from that clip. That information didn't seem to be available. Dr. Johnson does seem to question if this was indeed the murder weapon for reasons that we've mentioned already. And due to the injuries on Lavina, which he believes not only to be a physical impossibility, but also the gravity of the head injury, it just doesn't seem to line up. He thinks that an M16 would more or less blow a skull apart. Like he said that he's seen these injuries personally. He had actually...
It would.
Yeah, he said he had a patient that he was treating and they chose to complete suicide with an M16 and it destroyed this individual's skull. And like I said, I'm not a medical doctor or a ballistics expert, but it just doesn't seem to line up for me either.
No, it's the same for me. She's 5'1". That's what I can't get over. So like her little arms are so short when you're looking at trying to position that kind of gun. And again, if I am desperate to not be here anymore, that's a very risky way to try to kill yourself, because especially when you're struggling to pull a trigger, that could shoot the side of your face or leave you paralyzed or those types of things, which would be even worse than the hell you're facing right now. So I don't know. It just seems like a really different, difficult choice for her, given her stature and the way her body was found. That's what complicates it for me. Do you guys know, because I haven't seen these reports, What was the injury to her skull? Was it a simple hole in her skull? Like, was her skull intact?
That's what he said.
The problem with them trying to say that it was an M16 that she committed suicide with comes down to, and I'm going to nerd out here a little bit, just to basic physics, because the muzzle velocity for an M16, the speed of the bullet coming out of the barrel, is more than two times as much as like a 9mm. I think the M16, it's a little over 3,000 feet per second, whereas a 9mm is around 1,200 feet per second. So the 9mm is slower. So when the round is coming out of an M16, it's coming out faster and harder. So it's going to inflict more damage as opposed to a 9mm.
Like, what's the bullet like?
It's bigger.
The ones that like actually pull apart. And what are those bullets called? Those,
gosh, I should
know. You know the ones I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. Do these shatter or like
hollow tips? Hollow points.
Hollow points. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, because a 9mm round is so much smaller than an M16 round. So just the size between the two, the M16 is going to inflict more damage. Mm-hmm. It's coming out faster. It's bigger. Not to be crude, but like it's going to blow a big hole, especially if the rifle is in her mouth, as opposed to a 9mm either in the mouth or to the temple. It's still going to be gruesome and messy, but it's not going to be as severe as an M16.
And then when you talk about her teeth being messed up, it's like the gun was in her mouth, you would think that, yes, there could be some damage from like just the muzzle firing backwards, but I wouldn't think it would shatter all of your teeth. I mean, maybe it would, because there is a big kickback on the gun. So maybe there would be.
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I would assume if it was an M16, there would be significant damage to the teeth. But it's hard to say because we don't know for sure. And I'm assuming there are not pictures out there of her face or anything like that. Something for someone to see and look and be like, well, no, this is clearly a 9mm or a small arms weapon versus, you know, a rifle.
I think Dr. Johnson did some research on intraoral gunshot wounds and the results on your teeth. And I think this was atypical because, yeah, there is kickback. There is those sorts of things. So to have your teeth actually knocked out when the barrel is, for those of you listening, like the barrel, when somebody is going to typically put it in their mouth, is going to be past their teeth. So whether or not you're clenching down on that gun, or the force leaving might leave before you can clench, that kickback might kick out of your mouth before it could even damage your teeth. I'm not really sure. And no one's really going to be testing that specifically, because maybe you could replicate the conditions. But I think he did enough research to kind of deduce that this was a low probability that her teeth would be so, so damaged and she would have such a small exit wound in her head from an M16. It just didn't seem to line up. And I mean, Dr. Johnson's an incredibly credible person. Not only is he a grieving father and, you know, watching the documentary, A Silent Truth, it's very clear Lavina's mother, Mrs. Johnson, she just was like, I'm going to do the grieving for the both of us. She literally said that. And you are going to, you know, do the fighting part because I don't have it in me. So you get out there in front of it. And they're such a wonderful family. And he's such a smart man. And he's been so strong in the face of such adversity, but I really and truly believe that everything that Dr. Johnson says is well-researched and credible. Of course, as a family member, you have some kind of bias, but I think he's as unbiased as you can be being a family member, if that makes sense.
That made me cry. And he's like, oh, no, I have to go watch the documentary.
It's really heartbreaking. It's a really good documentary. It's where before, like I think a lot of the podcasts and stuff, and when I first did my initial episode, the military report wasn't available. And I really don't think most people's coverage includes the military report. Even Margot's doesn't. Because when we were going to redo this, she's like, oh my gosh, like I found this. And this explains so, so much. I had no idea either. I had to go back and like rewrite everything to include this as well. And it just gives it a more balanced report because that way it's like, okay, we've heard what the military has to say. Now we can draw our own conclusions based on this report, which before it was basically only what the family was saying. So it's hard not to approach it with bias because they have already drawn their conclusions and their assumptions. And not to say that they're incorrect at all. Like I'm much more inclined to believe what the family already thinks. But I think to be balanced and to come at this from all angles, I think you need to read what the military has to say and you need to then draw your conclusions. So we're fortunate enough that we have that material.
So there was an M16 lying close to Lavina's body, according to the rough crime scene sketch, but it's not right beside her, as one would assume. The gun was drawn several feet away, and this seemed to be too far away for Lavina to have shot herself. It's an unnatural position for the gun to fall if one had actually used it to shoot themselves, and then you will instinctively fall over after completion. And so one would think that this M16 would be found very close by at the foot of her body. But then again, there are contradicting witness statements who said it was on her body, on her left side. Some said the muzzle was facing up. Others said down. So again, there's no clarity to this. There's lots of differing accounts, and it's not a small point. This is something that's very important in determining what exactly happened. And it matters the accuracy of where the rifle was found, as well as the position of where it was found, because that could show the difference between a legitimate suicide and a staged murder scene.
I'm also unsure if the hyoid bone had ever been checked or if Lavina's eyes had been checked for petechial hemorrhaging, which are all potential signs of manual strangulation or asphyxiation. And though we often believe these things always show up, that's just not always the case. So let's just for a moment say that due to the lividity on the left side of her body, that perhaps Lavina had been deceased and the scene was staged. The gunshot was done later to set the scene and she was killed in another way. So it doesn't appear that Lavina has any sort of ligature strangulation marks, because that would have likely left clear bruising that the family would have seen. You couldn't cover this up. But sometimes manual strangulation doesn't leave clear indications. According to Forensic Pathology, second edition by Vincent J. DeMeo and Dominic DeMeo, which I highly recommend. It was recommended to me by the pathologist I mentioned earlier, Dr. Joe DeFlew. And it's been an incredible resource when investigating cases that are ruled suicides that seem to be not so cut and dry. There's a really good section on asphyxiation and strangulation. It's really, really interesting for anyone who is very interested in these suicide versus murder cases. It's been a great resource for me personally.
I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds very fascinating. It's hard because we want these things to be so cut and dry. And It's, you know, there's this hope and that there's going to be a definite answer in these cases, because anything other than definite answers seems impossible to fathom, right? And so, especially when you talk about a suicide versus a homicide, because there's complications after each of those that are very, very different. And so these families, the family of Lavina, they're sitting there with multiple things that they're having to process: social stigmas, benefits, struggles, the way people react to them, right? And could I have done more? What if I had said the right thing? But then that's not what I think happened. I think she was killed and people are covering it up. So it's like, you can't even fathom the grief and trauma that this family is going through, because they're getting multiple issues thrown at them at once, where they're having to grieve a death. They're having to cope with social stigma of a suicide, personal blame that they place on themselves for a suicide and these types of things. And then they're also battling this idea that I think I'm also being lied to, almost like we're being gaslighted by people. And that's adding more trauma. And like you just said, I broke my heart when you said the mom said, I'll grieve for the both of us because I can't do anything else and you're going to have to investigate. He needed to be grieving. And yet now what you've done is you've stolen his right to grieve his baby, and he's fighting to solve her case. Like it's sad. It makes me very sad. I'm very sensitive tonight, but it makes me really sad that it's like, he should have been grieving his baby and knowing what happened to her. And yet it feels like in this case that got stolen away from him. And they're having to process so many more things than just the death of their daughter.
Yeah, I really feel for the Johnsons. Like, they're having to get out in front of this. Like, there's two brothers, a sister that we don't hear from, that I can imagine are in their own, you know, dealing with their own pain, their own grief. They're not doing it in front of the camera. And it's so difficult because Dr. Johnson's not able to, like you said, Ash, he can't grieve. Because of the lack of investigation, that he doesn't feel his daughter's death has been looked into properly, he then has to get out in front of it. He's petitioning Congress, like congressmen, senators. He's out there, you know, trying to make change through politics, hoping that it will get to the right person and that somebody will go, there's a problem here. And I mentioned on earlier in one of our episodes that their congressional correspondence and the correspondence with senators and I think like state representatives is all in the military's report. And there are so many congressmen and senators that are like, okay, there's something wrong here. They're looking at what Dr. Johnson's saying, and there's obviously validity. There is a father grieving, yes, but look at the facts. Like, mm-hmm. these are in black and white, and it looks like the military is covering something up. Whether they are or they just did a crappy investigation, I don't know for sure. But I think anyone who looks at this goes, there's something wrong here.
And just imagine if this had happened to a family who didn't have somebody like Dr. Johnson at the head, who didn't have the experience that he had, didn't have the knowledge, didn't have the education that he had, the specific education in dealing with soldier suicides. All of those things greatly benefited him in reaching out to Congress and getting the ball rolling and trying to find out what happened to Lavina. If this had been another family without those resources or without that knowledge, and they just believed what the military told them, then that's what breaks my heart, knowing that as awful as this is and what the Johnsons are having to go through is unforgivable, they also have a little bit of, I don't even know what I'm trying to say, I guess, a little more to lift them up mm-hmm. and yeah. help them.
It's more information to fall back on. Yes. So it's like, it's ironic. I mean, totally different. But like when Bud passed away, I thought, like, was all of my training in sudden death and grief to prepare me to have the tools to deal with this? And like, here you have Dr. Johnson, who specialized in soldier suicide. And it's like, here he is. It's like kind of a curse and a gift where mm-hmm. he's carrying this burden, but he has the knowledge to fight. And like you said, I mean, you nailed it. Look at how many families probably suffer and don't even know what questions to ask or to even think that something could be covered up, because I just exactly. have to trust you're telling me the truth. He knew enough to say, I don't think you are. And right. so, like you said, he had that, and he had the education and the credentials to get powerful people to listen.
Yeah, he had that edge. He got Senator Lacey Clay in his corner right away. And like we'd mentioned earlier, that there was likely somebody who was on the inside telling Dr. Johnson, there's blood in the tent, there was blood outside, these things that weren't reported. Well, when they originally got the redacted report and the family got the autopsy report, they had all the photos and all those things, but they got black and white photos. And some of the black and white photos, not of the autopsy, but they're included in the military's report, and they're awful. You can't see anything. There's like 20 photos of debris. And it's like, this is black and white. What is this? Photos of the interior of the tent? It's terrible. Once I got those color photos, we'll talk about them later, but everything changed.
Wow.
Lavina allegedly was killed with one bullet, but the strange thing is that it was never found. And the question that I have in my mind is, where is it? This happened in a tent. Tents are not solid. Bullet can go right through. But did investigators even bother checking the tent for gun holes or any kind of evidence that it even left the tent? It all depends a lot on, I think, the trajectory and how she was shot. Was she on the ground? Was she standing? We don't know any of that. And what stands out is that they never found this bullet. I mean, it's going to be small. The tent is small. It's closed. And it really is hard to wrap my mind around the fact that it wasn't recovered. And this is one of the reasons that Dr. Johnson suggests that the wound looks more like that of a 9mm. And like I said earlier, the muzzle velocity of an M16 is much faster and would cause significantly more damage than a smaller weapon like a 9mm. And it's possible that at either speed, as well as the trajectory that she shot herself, the round could have gone through the tent, never to be seen again. But again, there would be a bullet hole to suggest that. But if she was shot on the ground after she had been killed, it's possible, if it is a 9mm or something similar, like Dr. Johnson suspects, it could have either remained in the body or it could have gone through and been trapped in the sand below her. Mm-hmm. But the fact that there was no indication that any of that was looked into, it's pretty clear that the investigation and the evidence gathering was minimal and half-assed, and the time of death unknown, and What is also strange, we've talked about a little, are the fires near her body during those early hours. Some witness accounts say that Lavina's body was also smoking as if it was on fire or had been on fire. And it almost seems like these tiny fires are just another way to distract, to confuse, to throw investigators off the scent and make them look at it as more as a suicide. But again, if you're going to complete suicide.
So that wraps up part 3 of our series on Lavina Lynn Johnson. Stay tuned for part 4. I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter, so please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.